you have a really interesting history, you know, in both psychiatry and medicine, as well as your other interesting. I saw that you went to clown college, for example, and which is really interesting to me, being a theater background. But when I invited you to do this, there must have been, you know, perhaps a personal reason why you were willing to do this interview, and maybe we can begin there. What for you is an important? Why does writing matter to you? Why does good writing matter to you?
Well, I'd like my life. I suspect that all of us who are here at the university have, at some level, a shared purpose, which is to make our lives as meaningful and purposeful and contributory as possible. In a way, that's what is sometimes called our sacred question. How do we make our lives as meaningful and contributory as we possibly can? And one of the things which becomes apparent if you start to reflect on a question like that, or whatever your particular sacred question is that the depth of one's life is a function of how much one explores and responds to those kind of questions. So given the idea that all of us probably would like our lives to be as meaningful and contributory as possible, then for an awful lot of us, that means communicating effectively. And that means in our contemporary literary world and Western world, that means both speaking and writing. And so those are two of the great skills that all of us are called on to have a happy life, to have an effective life, and to have a contributory life. Mm-hmm. So I found it rather paradoxical at a certain stage to realize that I had spent an enormous number of years acquiring a massive amount of information, as one does in medical school and PhD degrees, and I did both. And yet, I'd never really learned much about how to communicate this information. Huh. And when I came to writing, I found that I was writing in the style of what should we call it, academies, which was the kind of writing style I'd been exposed to in my medical professional and scientific training, and that medical ease had its purpose, a very technical, very abstract, very precise, which was fine, but if I wanted to communicate to a larger audience, if I wanted to get ideas out to the larger world, and I had to learn how to communicate in a way that would get to them.
Was there a specific moment or event, or was there a specific thing that you were writing on in which, that you can recall, that was when you realized, oh my gosh, I've been co-opted. I'm writing in a style that is not appropriate for this.
Yes, it was a very, very precise time. At the height of the Cold War, I, like so many of us, became horrified when I realized that there was a high risk that we would destroy the planet and our civilization, that we would cause billions of deaths, and that basically human existence now hung by a nuclear thread. And so I began looking at how could I make a contribution to this field, and it eventually became clear that what I could do was write on the psychological dimensions of this. What are the psychological forces which have led us to this horrendous situation, and what impact is this situation having on people? So I started to write a popular book, and I presented my first draft to my wife, who read the first two pages and who said, you know, if you want to save the world, it'd be really nice if people could actually read this.
As only wives can do.
only spouse can do. So I realized she was right, and I went back and rewrote it, and she read through the first two chapters this time and said, well, this is better, but now go and rewrite it. And I realized that I could not write in a way that was going to be accessible and impactful for people. And that if I wanted to have an influence in life, and if I really wanted to have a larger impact on the world, I really need to learn how to communicate effectively. I need to learn how to speak better to the public, and I need to learn how to write in a very particular kind of way. I need to learn how to write in a way that was accessible, mm-hmm. yet accurate mm-hmm. and true.
And so what did you do to help yourself meet that goal?
Well, it's something I'm still doing.
Okay.
It's an ongoing process. It's been ongoing for 20 years. A number of things. Firstly, reading people who know how to write well. Mm-hmm. And second, getting feedback from as many people as I could. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, hiring people to teach me. Paying editors to read my manuscripts and give detailed criticism. It's very, very curious to pay someone to insult you, but it's been absolutely invaluable. And I think students at a university have a remarkable opportunity to get this as part of their education instead of having to do it as a remedial education as I did,
right.
And I'm still doing. And then the process of writing and rewriting and rewriting, just looking not only looking for clarity and precision and ease and emotive power, something which will bring forth the appropriate, skillful, helpful emotions, mm-hmm. and make a piece of writing a dynamic, lively, engaging, emotionally moving piece of work. And that was, learning that has been a kind of counterbalance, or learning a whole new art form compared to the abstract academies, mm-hmm. which was deliberately divorced from affect, from passion, from personality, from myself as a writer, from any subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And that kind of reporting has its value in the
yes.
scientific world, and it's well worth learning, and I still need to master that. And it's also important to learn how to write for not just a narrow professional audience, but a larger audience. Mm-hmm. And all of us will at various times be communicating to multiple audiences. And
yes.
So that was one point. Another related point was when I, about the same time, when I went to a lecture by someone who just was absolutely brilliant, engaging, and humorous, and lively, and moving, and a thought arose in the middle of that, I've got to learn how to speak well. This man is impacting an audience of 1,000 people in a way I never could. I've got to learn this. So I went and got speech lessons, and went to drama school, and comedy college, and mm-hmm. and improv school and so forth as a way of kind of learning some of those skills.
And what for you were some of the best skills that you worked on in all of that dramatic experiences? I mean, what really came fresh to you, or what
from
did you
the come, dramatic
yeah,
experiences?
Yeah, doing all that improv work. What did you gain as a speaker?
Interesting question. I'd say a trust in the it helped in the trust in one's own improvisational capacities and the looking for different perspectives and being broken out of my somewhat uptight academic mold. Mm-hmm. You know, I was pretty, being a pretty intellectual type, it was good to be busted out of that that kind of somewhat narrow way of thinking and being, and uh-huh. you know, opening up. You know this from your theater world.
Yes.
So that was good. Let's see, what else?
Well, I don't know if you'll even be able to answer this, but did you find that there was anything that translated then from becoming a better public speaker to your writing? Was there any crossover for you?
Yes, I think so. That is the a couple of things. One, another thing I did was I put myself out on a limb and hosted a radio show for a while. And it was one of the best educational experiences I've had, if also one of the more humbling, as was comedy school, stand-up comedy. But I had been used to the academic mode of presentation, very thoughtful, precise, reflective, slow. And on radio, if you hesitate for a moment, people are reaching for the knob to turn to a different station. Mm-hmm. And after I had a producer, a woman who was a young Gen Xer, and I listened to the tape of our first session, and she would introduce the show and come in on the breaks. It was like she was on speed and I was on Bob's, and it was like, this doesn't work. And I realized I was just going to have to, there couldn't be any pauses, any breaks, I just had to speak immediately. And I didn't know that it was possible to do that. I mean, I didn't mm-hmm. know I could do that. And yet, what I found was that it can happen. Mm-hmm. That I didn't need to calm, well, maybe I'm that if I just set the intention and opened my mouth, words would flow, and they somehow or other they seemed to make sense.
That's great.
And they had a little more juice and energy mm-hmm. than if I hummed and hawed and reflected for a few mm-hmm. minutes. So I think that flowed over a little bit to the writing, in as much as there's a trust in the more trust in that creative process.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that has been very, very important for me in writing. I'll bring it up because it's probably something you might not ask, and it's also something that other speakers aren't likely to talk about, and that is that meditation has been extremely important to me in my life. I've been doing fairly intensive meditation practice for over 30 years now. And when I, in my first years of writing, I would sit and try to think my way through something, an idea, or a book chapter, or an article, or something, and sit and try and ponder it, and blah, blah, blah. And then as my meditation practice deepened, what I found was what I could do was, as the mind became a little more trained, a little more fluid, a little clearer, lighter, more malleable, more quiet, more open to the creative process, that I could what I do now and have done for some years is I literally sit at my desk with a question, start with a question, okay, I need to write something on, let's see, pick a topic, you know, the effects of the economic crisis on psychological well-being. And what I do is I sit there just quietly in a kind of meditative place, and maybe I'll meditate for a few minutes first, and I'll just sit there quietly with that question, and then the mind will just create the response. Okay, the experience is it's back here, it creates itself, and then it comes as a kind of overview vision, so it's not like I'm trying to find, pecking on a keyboard, this idea, that idea, this idea. It comes more fully formed as, okay, all right, here's the gestalt, here's the picture. All right, now I need to find, now I need to get this down.
Right.
So it's a very, very different creative process.
Rather than rushing into the process, you're giving space for the process.
Giving space to the process, exactly, yes. And not even trying to figure it out so much as sit and trust the intuitive creative process that's available to us all.
But yes.
My mind was too busy and frenetic and filled with thoughts.
That does make sense. I mean, as a writer, I know that I've come to appreciate that often I'm writing all of the time without writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are times when I do need to step away from the desk and give myself a moment of calm. And there's the joke that, you know, a writer is never just staring out the window, right? A writer is always writing, even when they're staring out the window, right? That there's a little bit of that. And I think that that's really good advice for our students, actually, that there's a tendency to rush into the process before all of their ducks are in a row, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think that for me it's been really important to learn that at a deep level, you know, creativity is one of the great human mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And you know, psychologists will admit that, researchers will admit that. And one of the most important discoveries for me is that this creative process is much larger or transpersonal. It's larger than this little ego. And that we can, and yet we can open ourselves to the to that creative process. We can ready ourselves, make ourselves vessels for that creative process to come through. And in classic terms, it would be, you know, what was the phrase? The muses open. There was a phrase for something. The muses, you know.
Right. Being visited by the muses.
Yeah, visited. But you also, you know, you pray to the muses, or
right.
Invoke the muses.
Yes.
That's it. Invoke the muses. And yes, it is. And that mythological metaphor makes total sense as you begin to appreciate that, yes, it does feel like this creative process is something larger than our little individual psyches. It's something like we make ourselves ready for that creative process to flow through us.
So after that stage, what other stages in the writing process have you now realized, yes, this is a part of this is a necessary part of my process, just as beginning from the meditative state. Do you have other definable stages in your process? Or is it pretty, does it depend on the product at hand?
Well, the way I write is usually to open to that creative, of course, prior to that, the richness of the material that can flow through us and its degree of richness of interconnection and the coherence is clearly a function of the amount of information we've acquired and the amount of thought and reflection we've given to it. And in some ways you can tell how much a person has thought about a particular topic by the amount of interconnection of ideas. Obviously there's a kind of input and fertilization phase of acquiring information and reflecting on it. Then there's the opening, a quieting of the mind, the opening to a meditative place, the invoking of the muse, and then for me, what I find is important to get an outline down. And for me, the actual creation of the outline takes far longer than the actual writing of a first draft. And so I get a vision, literally see what's called the network logic of a topic. Then it's a matter of getting that down on paper as far as quickly as I can, and then fleshing out that framework until it feels like a rich, interconnected narrative flow, and then I dictate it, and then there's the rewriting. And for me, it just takes a lot of rewriting. Usually, mm-hmm. It's rare that I publish something which hasn't had double-digit revisions. Mm-hmm. My record is 41, so.
You're in good company.
And the other thing is, it's very important for me to get feedback. I try to get the writing in the best shape I can get it in, and then give it to a really good critic. And really good critics are just priceless.
Do you have now set of people that you go back to again and again? Who are your favorites for that work?
Well, at this stage, the two kinds of feedback I get for articles, I'm usually looking for people who have some expertise in the field for books, particularly ones where I'm trying to reach a larger audience and where the style is so much more important. I usually still hire at least two different editors, mm-hmm. and have two people go through it. Because each editor has a different perspective and makes a different contribution, as you know.
Yes.
And it's quite remarkable sometimes to see how different the people's focus and emphasis and contributions are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question in a very useful way, but when you look at your own students' work, I imagine these days you're working mostly with graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
But even with graduate students, when you're looking at their output and you're responding to their writing, do you find that there are trends today that might be different in terms of their ability to communicate clearly? Are there things you just wish they would have known before they even got to graduate school?
Well, I'm mainly working with psychiatry trainees, so most of the work I do with them is clinical supervision, so I don't actually do much in the writing. There's not a lot of their written output, or if it is, it's scribbled case notes that do not pass any literary test. And given their time constraints, it's hardly surprising.
I usually close out the interviews with an open-ended question, a broad question. Is there anything that, we haven't talked about at this point that to you is, again, comes to the heart of the matter for you about writing, not only just why it's important, but what about it that, well, for lack of a better word, brings you joy? Yeah.
Let's see. Two things come to mind. I think one thing we haven't talked about is the fact that writing on a topic almost invariably leads to greater depth of insight and clarity of insight and recognition of connections, understandings that don't emerge in any other way. I can read extensively on a topic, but it's only when I sit down to write on it and have to really struggle with ideas and connections and make things clear that I'm forced to new depths of understanding and clarification for myself. So I would want to emphasize the incredible intellectual and value of writing as an intellectual tool and clarification and method of understanding.
Yes.
So I know if I write a book, I know that at least one person is going to learn a hell of a lot. So. or, you know, if I write anything significant, any on any significant topic. So that's one thing in terms of what brings pleasure. I would say that writing for me is not so much a pleasure as it is satisfying. And there's both an intellectual and an aesthetic satisfaction. There's an intellectual satisfaction that comes from crafting a network of ideas, from seeing what literally seeing a, and it's called vision logic, seeing a network of ideas and how they cohere. It is literally a vision, but an intellectual vision. Mm-hmm. And that is intensely intellectually satisfying, but there's also, for me and other people I've spoken to, an aesthetic pleasure about that. It's an intellectual.
Aesthetic pleasure of putting the words together.
Well, of seeing this vision, of literally seeing. Oh, okay. Wow, this all fits together. I see how it all fits, and if that is also combined, if that is also oriented towards illuminating, informing, empowering, motivating readers, then there's also a, if in other words it has been crafted as an intellectual visionary argument or compelling call of some type, then there's also a deep satisfaction that comes from feeling that, oh, this could really contribute.
And we've come back to the beginning of where we started, the idea of being contributory, which is an excellent way to stop.